Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. Let me cover the one thing I didn't cover yesterday. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And this still is the only show that goes through the academic evidence that is necessary so that we can place context to what the heck's going on. I get all sorts of people sending me questions. I even get called on the weekends for those who have my access to my number regarding details on the Constitution. Case in point, a group of people were meeting, having cognac and cigars, and the question of state rights came up and so forth. And I want people to understand that the states do have a privilege of governing their citizens to a much greater degree than the federal government. Most people think that the U.S. Constitution is what drives all the states. That's the furthest thing from the truth. The U.S. Constitution is what defines and limits the general government. It also provides protections from both the general government and the state, but it does not necessarily drive the state governments. So the question is, what is it that your state can do? Can your state actually, possess the authority and mandate health care upon you? Can they oppress you? Well, yes and no. They can't force you to receive anything. There is such a thing that is an individual privilege and immunity, and it's called the right of conscience. And you have the absolute right over your children, over yourself. You have the right to refuse treatment, to refuse assistance. They cannot tie you down and inject you. They cannot force you into something that is going to occur to you. In other words, they can't force you into specific care and treatment. Now, they can put you into a facility if you are harmful. In other words, if you're sick, they can actually quarantine you to a facility until you're healthy again. But they just can't lock you up because you refuse treatment, and then they consider that a crime. Just remember, they can't pass ex post facto laws, something that was completely legal and now they make it illegal. They can't do that either. They can't pass bills of attainder. They can't, make a block of people people that believe a certain thing or anything like that. They cannot, make that illegal, your membership in something illegal and so forth. Anyway, so you have to go through your state constitutions and you have to understand what powers were truly delegated. Here's the question. And here is the test that you must actually apply to every state. Are the laws that have been created in your state, whether they're constitutional or not, were they created based on a requirement from the federal government? Now, a lot of states, state that I'm in, has a clause right up top. I think it may be Article 2 or whatever, Article 1. It's right in the very front end of the Constitution that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And so many people just quickly make the connection that if the federal government requires something, then that is constitutional. Well, no, it's not. If the federal government requires environmental protection measures to be initiated or a fellow Environmental Protection Agency at the state level to interface with the federal level, that's not constitutional. It has to be within the jurisdiction and the framework of the Constitution for the federal government to actually require that. The states are actually supposed to push back. That's their job, is to push back and say, "What? You don't have the authority to do that." So there's lots of things like that that your states have created, and they've given themselves, in doing so, general powers over the environment. Why is it you think that people are losing their homes? There was a gentleman, I think it was in Colorado, where a person created their own fish pond, something like that. And so they wanted to, have their own fishing hole or what have you. Are people losing their homes over trees or something because the federal government has come in and created this association with the state government? And what they've done is they've changed their constitution and they've changed their laws to adapt to this federal bureaucracy, which is unconstitutional. The only way your federal government, or I should say your state government, can change your constitution is whatever that process is. Did they take it to the vote of the voters? Or did they have the two-thirds, whatever? You need to also understand what it takes to change your state constitution. And if it takes strictly a popular vote election, then that's a democracy. If you understand what I just said, then that is a democracy. And you have a right to challenge your state's constitution to say, we're supposed to have a Republican form of government, and to change the essence of our government, our constitution, by just a popular vote is the same thing as a democracy. It is not a Republican form of government. So what you should be doing is you really need to start pursuing educating people and getting people on board with making the barrier for changing your constitution much more difficult. In other words, requiring a majority of the counties, not a majority of the people. Because that means that you have 50% plus one counties on board with whatever change is necessary. 9 times out of 10, you'll find that that will not be representative of the people. And this is how the lower populated counties actually protect themselves. But anyway, you need to start challenging. You need to get very smart on your own state constitution. I know I live in a state where they're violating their own constitution. They're doing all sorts of things. The limitlessness in what they feel constrained is gone. I mean, they have no constraints as far as our government goes. They believe they can do anything and everything. And Governor Inslee, other than the fact that he's a tyrant and a despot, the guy is a very evil person, and he is. And there's many other state governors out there. Cuomo. There are lots of governors out there that believe they're kings or princes, and that they can, their royal highnesses can challenge the federal government if the federal government isn't doing the progressive things that they want to do. We're so screwed up, folks. We are so screwed up, even at the state level, that doing all of these things at the state level can only, to fix these things, can only come to pass if we can initiate republic review. It's really that simple. It really is. This is why the upcoming election in the dark red states is so critical. We need to get the constitutional challengers to the rhinos in place. We need to have a state legislature willing to stand up and declare that we must audit the Constitution. We must stand up to the federal tyranny and force the federal government into compliance. We can do this. We need your help. So this is, You know, how often do I ask you for money? I say, if you want to contribute, you can. I don't say, hey, you know, I don't do those threatening things like you see ministers and other people do. We may not be able to put this show on anymore unless you pay. We don't do that. What we do is we ask you to invest in things that will actually make a difference. Getting people who are supporters, true supporters of the Constitution, into office is paramount. This is where, and this is why, we are asking you to support these things. So these things are critical and important, and I can go on and on. I'm not going to plug anything. I could easily plug Red State Coffee. I could plug my books and those types of things. What we need to do is we need to get into the cod fishery debates today. And then we'll get into the highlights of the Federalist Papers. And then we'll probably get into Madison's letter to John J. Jackson, John G. Jackson, I mean. And then we'll probably look at getting things all queued up to going into the vetoes, as well as we'll probably get into the resolutions. Actually, I think we'll do the resolutions next, but we will tell you what's in the queue when we come back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, just to actually set this up as to where we're going, let's look first at where we've been. We've covered the scale of liberty, and we've discussed those who are on the diametrically opposing ends, from individual liberty to individual sovereignty, and on the other end, subjugation and enslavement. We've talked about we talked about republicanism, the natural law. We just talked about the Tory Acts. We've talked about the difference between our Constitution, an enumerated Constitution, and a general Constitution. We even covered the essay on property, and we just covered the Tory Acts so that we could set the stage for understanding how they started moving forward. This is even before the Constitution. Actually, the essay on property was, it's out of the timeline, but I just wanted to put it into context that your liberties are property. And when people take your liberties, they are stealing your property. Now, we're getting into the cod fisheries, the bounties, allowances, whatever you want to call them, whatever they call them. The fact of the matter is, this is where there was the initial congressional challenges to some of the clauses. And I'll give you a little backstory on this as we go along. We're also going to get into the Federalist Papers. So I'm going to go kind of backwards now and then discuss the Federalist Papers and the highlights of what was covered in the Federalist Papers. There's a lot of good meat in the Federalist Papers. There's a lot of good insights in the Federalist Papers. But the Federalist Papers are not legally binding. That's why I don't put all the emphasis as Publa, Hedlet, Publa, or whatever, you know, Joanne's name is, that are pseudonym. And I, you know, you listen to John Birchers, you listen to lots of people that speak on behalf of the Constitution and using the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were just essays that were thrown out into the public forum to give people insights. They are not legally binding. They're insightful, but they're not legally binding. This is where Hamilton was able to provide red herrings. He was able to create straw man arguments. He created paper tigers, whatever you want to call it. He used the latitude of not being under oath, of not, you know, testifying to the facts and to the truth to the people in the convention. So there's a huge difference between the ratification debates, what was said during those, and the Federalist Papers. So when somebody starts citing the Federalist Papers, you should interrupt them and say, do you realize that there are far better reliable documents that give more detail and more insights than the Federalist Papers? They're called the ratification debates. Are you aware of that? And 9 times out of 10, they'll go, oh, well, yeah, they're interesting, but this is, you know, this is where they no, actually, it's during the ratification debates where these things were defined. So anyway, as we move forward, what we're going to get into after the cod, so we're going to do the cod fisheries, the Federalist Papers. What we're going to do after the Federalist Papers is the resolutions, the 1798 resolution, 1799, and 1800 notes on the resolutions. Then we're going to cover the vetoes, Madison, Monroe, and Jackson, Andrew Jackson. And then we'll cover Madison's letter to John G. Jackson. And then we'll probably start preparing to getting into the ratification debates again. So at this point in time, we're also, just so you understand, if a state legislator comes and says, you know, I'd like to, you know, have a talk to you, we will make sure that we provide that time. I don't have the time to beg or plead state legislators. So if we get one, it's great. But anyway, if you have a state legislator that says, you know, I need your support, I'm standing on the Constitution, tell them to contact me. We'll see if they're standing on the Constitution or not. Anyway, as we move forward, I also want to make sure that you're helping, because one way you can help, this is not asking you to pull your wallet out. One thing you can help is you can actually start letting people know that there is a solution-based show. Why do we go through these things? Why do I read these documents? Why do I share this insight and this critical information? Because I don't want you to take my word for it. The academic case is set. We must call for a full audit with Republic Review and force the federal government into the framework before it is too late, period. So anyway, let me just kind of move forward. What we're doing is we're going to cover the bounty payments, right? And so what we want to do is kind of give you a a little bit of a background. So the cod fishery bounty payments, or bounty payments for the cod fisheries, kind of came to be in the early 1792 year. On February 3rd, the Committee of the Whole began consideration of the bill. And for encouragement of, you know, getting a vote for the bounty, that's what they were calling it, or an allowance, I think is what they changed it to. So that it's already passed the Senate, and it was going into. So here's the interesting thing. The Senate had already passed this thing, and the Senate had already kind of, you know, said, yeah, we want to start getting state welfare going so that our state can start benefiting. Hey, you guys got this. Now, what about us? See, they were already starting to take whacks at the Constitution. So anyway, so the debate kind of kicked off. But Mr. Giles on February 3rd stated this. The present section of the bill, he continued, appears to contain a direct bounty on occupations, and if that be its object, it is the first attempt as yet made by this government to exercise such authority, and its constitutionality struck him in a doubtful point of view. For in no part of the Constitution could he, in express terms, find a power given to Congress to grant bounties on occupations. The power is neither directly granted nor, by any reasonable construction that he could give, annexed to any other specified power in the Constitution. Okay, so on February 7th, some note this is February 7th, some note this is February 6th, because the records were not necessarily that clear. But Mr. Williamson, in a speech immediately preceding Mr. Madison's speech, defended the bill by invoking the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution. And this is what Mr. Williamson said. In the Constitution of this government, there are two or three remarkable provisions which seem to be in point. It is to provide that direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers. It is also provided that all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. And it is provided that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commercial revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. The clear and obvious intention of the articles mentioned was that Congress might not have the power of imposing unequal burdens, that it might not be. So as you hear these things, think about some of the modern day context, like the TARP funding. Here they taxed America trillions of dollars, or what's going on today, and how they're handing money out to states that is unequal. Just in the concept, let's say they can do these things in the concept of equal distribution, a uniform application, they are imposing unequal burdens upon some states than other states. The clear and obvious intention of the articles mentioned was that Congress might not have the power of imposing unequal burdens, that it might not be in the power to gratify one part of the union by oppressing another. They've been getting away with this all the time. It appeared possible, and not only improbable, that the time might come when, by greater cohesion, by more unanimity, by more address, the representatives of one part of the union might attempt to impose unequal taxes or to relieve their constituents at the expense of the people. To prevent the possibility of such combination, the articles I have mentioned were inserted in the Constitution. I do not hazard much in saying that if the present Constitution had never been adopted without those preliminary guards on the Constitution, established the general doctrine of bounties and the provisions I have mentioned become useless. They vanish into air, and like the baseless fabric of a vision, leave not a trace behind. The common defense and general welfare in the hands of a good politician may supersede every part of this Constitution and leave us into the hands of chance. Now, I think what I did was I mentioned Mr. Williamson in a speech immediately preceding. Actually, it was Mr. Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence was the one that defended the use of the general welfare and defense clause. And so, Mr. Williamson, let me get back to what Mr. Williamson is saying here. The common defense and welfare in the hands of a good politician. We will repeat that when we're under stress. We will repeat that when under stress. Anyway, we'll get back to the common defense line that he starts off with here as soon as we're done with these two promos. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back with the cod fishery bounty details. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
So let me get back to this. But this these segments aren't all together. And as a matter of fact, you can get all of this information from the Constitution Society. I think you can even get these debates from the LOC, from the Library of Congress, so that you can kind of see everything as it's, you know, from the beginning, the introduction, and all the different conversations and discourses throughout the few days. But here's the interesting thing. Mr. Williamson is actually pointing out the uniformity clause and saying basically that the application of the general welfare clause is always, when it's used in this context, is always, always being broken and violated. So anyway, he goes on and says this: the common defense and welfare in the hands of a good politician may supersede every part of our Constitution and leave us in the hands of time and chance. Manufacturers in general are useful to the nation. They prescribe the public good and general welfare. How many of them are springing up in the northern states? See, he's pointing out that the northern states are becoming factory states. the beginning of the industrial era, and I'm not talking about the Industrial Revolution, but the industrial era is starting to show its face. And if you've ever heard of the Rust Belt begins in the north and it works its way down towards the center of the United States, into Pennsylvania and so forth. And so he's pointing out that, hey, you know, we're still agrarian down here in the South. And look, they are in manufacturing. They're creating, you know, supposedly this good thing. Let them be properly supported by bounties, and you will find no occasion for unequal taxes. The tax may be equal in the beginning, but it will be sufficiently unequal in the end. The object of the bounty and the amount of it are equally to be disregarded in the present case. We are simply to consider whether bounties may safely be given under the present Constitution. For myself, I would rather begin with a bounty of 1 million per annum than 1,000. I wish that my constituents may know whether they are to put any confidence in that paper called the Constitution. Unless the southern states are protected by the Constitution, their valuable staple and their visionary wealth must occasion their destruction. 3 short years has this government existed. It is not 3 years, but we have already given serious alarms to many of our fellow citizens. Establish the doctrine of bounties, set aside the part of the Constitution which requires equal taxes and demands similar distributions, destroy this barrier. And it is not a few fishermen that will enter claiming $10,000 or $12,000, but all manner of persons, people of every trade and occupation may enter in at the breach until they have eaten up the bread of our children. So if you see his point, the intent was never there. And as a matter of fact, this is what Mr. Madison says. And so we might actually be able to get through this in today because this is a few pages. But Mr. Madison says this: in the conflict, I feel between my disposition on one hand to afford every constitutional encouragement to the fisheries and my dislike on the other of the consequences apprehended from some clauses in the bill. I should have forborne to enter into this discussion if I had not found that over the above such arguments as appear to be natural and pertinent to the subject, others have been introduced which are, in my judgment, contrary to the true meaning and even strike at the characteristic principles of the Constitution. Let me premise, however, to the remarks which I shall briefly offer on the doctrine maintained by these gentlemen that I make a material distinction in the present case between an allowance as a mere commutation and modification of a drawback, and an allowance in the nature of a real and positive bounty. I make a distinction also as a subject of fair consideration, at least between a bounty granted under the particular terms in the Constitution, quote, a power to regulate trade, close quote, and one granted under the indefinite terms which have been cited as authority on occasion. I think, however, the term bounty is in every point of view improper as it is applied here, not only because it may be offensive to some and, in the opinion of others, carries a dangerous implication, but also because it does not express the true intention of the bill as avowed and advocated by its patrons themselves. For if the allowance, nothing more is proposed than a mere reimbursement of a sum advanced, it is only paying a debt, and when we pay a debt, we ought to not claim the merit of granting a bounty. It is supposed by some gentlemen the Congress have authority not only to grant bounties in the sense here used merely as a commutation for drawbacks, but even to grant them under a power by virtue of which they may do anything which they may think conducive to, quote, general welfare, close quote. This, sir, in my mind, raises the important fundamental question whether the general terms which have been cited are to be considered as a sort of caption of general description of the specified powers and have no further meaning and given no further power than what was found in the specification or as an abstract of the indefinite delegation of power extending to all cases, whatever. Now, what he basically just said was in the very front end of the Constitution, and I guess what I need to do is, let me see if I can pull it up. I will have to, let me see if I get the browser going. Let's find the Avalon. So what I will do is in the next break, I'll pull up the Constitution so I can read the beginning of Section 8. Because what Madison is pointing out is the very first clause, the introduction of Section 8 is a preamble to the specified powers behind below that. And that's why he's saying that is the general terms which have been cited as a considered a short caption or description of the specified powers or as having no further meaning and given no further power. So in other words, he's pointing out that preamble to Section 8 is not applying actual powers of general defense and welfare. It is basically describing in a high level the following specified powers and what they're going to do. So in other words, they are more or less kind of it's creating an abstract in the very front end of this. And so what he basically goes on and says is, then what is found in the specification abstract, indefinite delegation of power to all cases, to all such at least as will admit the application of money, which is given or giving as much latitude as any government could well desire. I have, sir, have always conceived, I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived, and it is still more fully known and more material to observe those who ratified the Constitution conceived, that this is not an indefinite government, deriving its powers from the general terms prefixed to the specified powers. Prefixed, it means the preamble, those few words in the front end. He says that those are not deriving powers. They're not creating any enumerated power. They're specifying the following powers. Again, it's a pretext. It is a preamble to those following defined powers. But a limited government tied down to the specified powers, which explain define the general terms. Excuse me. The gentlemen who contend for a contrary doctrine are surely not aware of the consequences which follow from it, and which they must either admit or give up their doctrine. It will follow in the first place, and I got to warn you, this is where Madison kind of gets out of his usual academic mode. Actually, he still stays in his academic mode, but he uses a shock value here. This is where Madison starts pointing out, if you allow this to start happening, then these things will start happening as well. And the things that he points out, I don't think he nor many of the men and women of the time knew and understood how debased America would become. Or he would have said abortion and homosexual marriage and those types of things, and everybody would have been aghast. However, what he did do was he tried to pull the strings of the main concerns of everybody of the time. They understood the government had no business in education. government had no business in taking care of compassionate services such as welfare and taking care of the sick, lame, and or the unemployed and those types of things. So anyway, he goes into poking people in the eye by using a shock value. We will be right back after these two promos. Please stay tuned. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so let's kind of move forward with this. And so let me kind of repeat what I said. And just as I'm reading, keep in mind, Madison kind of points out that there's this common knowledge out there that everybody understands what the heck these words mean because we've been using them for a long time and it's common knowledge. So anyway, it will follow in the first place that if the terms to be taken in the broad sense they maintain, the particular powers afterwards so carefully and distinctly enumerated would be without meaning and must go for nothing. It would be absurd to say first that Congress may do what they please, and then that they may do this or that particular thing after giving Congress power to raise money and apply it to all purposes which they may pronounce necessary to the general welfare, it would be absurd to say the least to superadd a power to raise armies and provide fleets and etc. In other words, here we're giving you this money to tax and to be able to do everything that you want to for the general welfare and defense, but now you have the power to provide for armies and navies and so forth. Why did they even list that? When they created the general powers, no, those were not general powers in that preamble. That preamble was just basically laying out a pretext for the following lists of powers. Madison goes on and says, in fact, the meaning of the general terms in question must either be sought in the subsequent enumerations, which limits and details them, or they convert the general government into one limited, as hitherto supposed, to the enumerated powers into a government without any limits at all. So in other words, either you you subscribe to the reality that it was a very limited and defined government, or they're completely unlimited, and that these men were were mischievous, they had evil machinations to subvert us to this greedy, avarice organization called the United States government. Anyway, Madison goes on, and this is where he starts talking about, you know, the history of these types of terms. It is to be recollected that the terms common defense and general welfare, as here used, are not novel terms first introduced into this Constitution. They are terms familiar in their construction and well known to the people of America. They are repeatedly found in the old Articles of Confederation, where although they are susceptible to as great latitudes as given them by the context here, it was never supposed or pretended that they conceived any such powers as is now assigned to them. On the contrary, it was always considered as a clear and certain that the old Congress was limited to the enumerated powers, and that the enumeration limited and explained the general terms. I asked the gentlemen themselves whether it ever was supposed or suspected that the old Congress could give away the money to the states in bounties to encourage agriculture or for any other purpose they pleased. If such a power had been proposed by that body, it would have been much less impotent or have borne a very different character from that universally ascribed to it. The novel idea now annexed to those terms and never before entertained by the friends or enemies of government will have a further consequence which cannot be taken into view of the gentlemen. Their construction would not only give Congress the complete legislative power I have stated, it would do more. It would supersede all the restrictions understood at present to lie on their power and respect to a judiciary. It would put in the power of Congress to establish courts throughout the United States with cognizance to suits between citizen and citizen, and in all cases whatsoever. See, my friends, this is what they've been doing. They've been, when Madison said, hey, you know, if you start having this concept and you start believing in this construct of how these, what these things really mean, then this is what's going to happen. And that's why it's happened. Even George Mason, when he talked about dismantling, marginalizing the militia to a point where it just becomes obsolete, ignored, and replaced by whatever the government wants to replace it by to enforce their own laws. That's why we have standing armies all over us. This, sir, seems to be demonstrable. For if the clause in question really authorizes Congress to do whatever they think fit, provided for the general welfare, or which they are to judge, and money can be applied to it, Congress must have the power to create and support a judiciary establishment, with the judiciary extending to all cases favorable in their opinion to the general welfare in the same manners they have power to pass laws and apply money, providing in any other way for the general welfare. I shall be reminded, perhaps, that according to the terms of the Constitution, the judicial power is to extend to certain cases only, not to all cases. But this circumstance can have no effect in the argument, it being, you know, like these homosexual marriages, like these laws and these cases where they actually have all of these people pursuing abortion, you know, between a person and a business and so forth. None of these cases, first off, they're not within the powers enumerated, nor are they within the scope of the federal judiciary. Anyway, Madison goes on and says, but this circumstance can have no effect in the argument, it being presupposed by the gentleman that the specification of certain objects does not limit the import of the general terms. Taking these terms as an abstract and indefinite grant of power, they comprise all the objects of the legislative regulation, as well as fall under the judiciary article in the Constitution, as those falling immediately under the legislative article. And if the partial enumeration of objects in the legislative article does not, as these gentlemen contend, limit the general power, neither will it limit the partial enumeration of objects in the judiciary article. In other words, he's saying that as they go down this path, Congress actually starts supposing what they want to do. This, I believe, was the foundation and the machinations in creating what we know today as the annotated Constitution, where Congress kind of just, you know, writes, okay, we're going to interpret this to be this way, and we're going to interpret this. They have to kind of keep track so that they can follow some rules, and that's why the annotated Constitution, something like 3,000 pages. And that's what Congress has done. Congress has ultimately, and the federal government has fully ignored the Constitution and the constitutional framework that the states are still going by. And there's way too many people in the state governments that know, understand, and allow the federal government to continually operate outside the defined boundaries of this U.S. Constitution. So they're allowing them to make it up as they go along, if you understand what I'm saying. Now, we're kind of at a point where we probably need to take a break because I'm looking over my shoulder. I've got just a little over a minute. So at this point in time, Madison has pointed out that there's this thing called the preamble, and the preamble didn't just create a general power, because if that was the case, then why did they even list the very specific powers of who was to execute, what they were to do, how they were to do this or that? That's what those enumerated powers were listed. The pretext, the preamble, which just basically was saying, you know, we're going to try to do this, and this is how we're going to accomplish this. And there it is. It granted no power in that preamble. Whatever is stated in that preamble, it's really granting no power, but it is applying a concept such as uniformity. Because if one reads the preamble, one will find that it does identify that things must be done uniformly. My friends, if we start looking at the Constitution the way they want us to look at the Constitution, then next thing you know, they will be able to convince us that they can put needles in our arms and inject us with whatever they want to. They can kill us if they want. They can change us. They can mold us because we're their subjects. They can do anything to that degree if we believe what they're telling us. This is why we have to stand on the legal definitions of the Constitution, not their interpretations of the Constitution. When the states defined these lines in the Constitution during the ratification debates, that was legally defining. In other words, they are set in stone, and there's no way they can be changed without amending the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we're going to finish this up in our next episode. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.